Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned, and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. Do you enjoy science? I do. Well, this next product from ZBiotics is some super cool science. That happens to be something I did some research on back as an undergraduate. You may not know that alcohol breaks down into acetaldehyde in the body, which is far more toxic than alcohol, and it does a lot of bad things to your body until it gets metabolized by your liver. It is one of the components that contributes to you feeling terrible after drinking. So the more alcohol, the more acetaldehyde you have, and thus the more terrible you feel. I looked into ways to break down acetaldehyde faster, but I didn't really have access to the PhD labs, so I basically concluded my only option was to go on a big long run in the morning and try and burn it off. This totally does help, but it's rather stressful. However, Zach Abbott, the founder of ZBiotics, did do a PhD. He looked into the processes of the liver and how it breaks down acetaldehyde, and he genetically engineered a probiotic that does the same process. So if you want to live a healthier lifestyle, you can take the ZBiotics probiotic formula, and this will help your body deal with acetaldehyde after drinking alcohol. Note, it will not stop any of the direct effects of alcohol, such as being drunk, becoming dehydrated, or losing sleep. It only relates to acetaldehyde. However, that is a great thing for you and certainly contributes to feeling better the next day, so I would really recommend it. ZBiotics are a super cool biotech company backed by Y Combinator. They are working on lots of other cool stuff coming soon. For now, all you can order is their probiotic for acetaldehyde. You can get 10% off your first order using GROWTH10 at checkout. So go to zbiotics.com/growthmindset to find out. Again, that's zbiotics.com/growthmindset and enter GROWTH10 at checkout. Enjoy with caution.
Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today I have Leah Chowdhury, who is the CEO of Pop-Up Party and Play and the first British Asian woman to swim the channel, which is a good feat.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure to have you on the podcast. Can we start with a short life summary, please?
Oh, wow. So I am the founder and CEO of Party and Play. We provide mobile childcare at corporate settings. So we go into large organizations and shared workspaces, members clubs, and provide childcare at their site. So we work with large organizations and kind of the office group, Annabelle's members club. They provide us with an area and we go in and provide childcare for them. So that's kind of like my work background. And yeah, as you mentioned, I am the first British Asian woman to swim the English Channel, raised £155,000 for charity doing that. And over my lifetime, I've worked with lots of children's charities, studying childhood studies at university. It's always been a passion to help children. So in my lifespan, raised £175,000 for charity. So yeah, worked with lots of different children, different settings.
Fascinating. So what's like your favorite study, would you say, of childhood? It's like the favorite like weird experiment that you're like, whoa, they should have done that, but that was really cool to find out, perhaps.
So one of the studies that really stuck with me, which was, well, obviously we couldn't do a lot of the studies because they're children. So we analyzed cases that had happened. So like situations that had happened, we would be able to analyze what's gone on and why children acted in that way, etc. And one of the case studies that really stuck with me was this case, she's called Jeannie. Probably a lot of people have heard of her. She was like really severely abused growing up. Like it was really sad to hear the stories. Like she was like put in like boiling hot baths and like it wasn't a really cool story, but it was something that really left a massive impact on me because it was saying that because of those early stages of life, she had suffered so much abuse and she never learned language. And then at 5, she was like placed with foster parents. At that point, she had a bit of a stable home. And later on in life, she never really fully developed language. So even when she was like 11, 12, 13, 14, she never really developed full sentences and things like that. So it was really interesting to see the nature and nurture stages of life. Even later on in life, even you have a great like upbringing and great treatments and supporting environment. If the earlier stages are affected, then it's scary because you can't do anything, you can't change. And like, actually, one of the biggest reasons why I went into like charity work and stuff was to like help children at those really early stages, to like give them a voice, help them as much as they can, because I've seen firsthand how much these experiences can affect your later life. And that one story really like hit home for me, which was early stages of life are very important.
That's a deep.
Sorry, I just took that.
Segment that into something really happy and fluffy.
Straight from one side to another.
Yeah. What do you think are the most important things besides being nice to your child and teaching them how to speak that you should be doing as a parent?
I think parents have a lot of pressure on them. And I think they're told this and they're given this advice and they're given that advice, etc. So just listen to yourself sometimes. Believe in yourself and your own abilities and don't feel like you're swayed by other people's opinions and things like that. I think that's probably the biggest bit of advice I could give to parents. I'm telling you, like, no one gives you a manual book.
Yeah.
So yeah, enjoy it as much as you can and just listen to your gut.
It's nice. Luckily, I'm not a parent.
It's like my job ad.
Slightly put off by that. You're not a parent, are you?
No, I'm not. No. So yeah, I've worked with children for nearly 10 years now. So in and out of different multiple settings, from volunteering at special needs through to like obviously studying child psychology at university and kind of doing placements and then working in a nursery. So I've been in and out of childcare and working with children for about 10 years now, which is quite scary and makes me feel really old. To be fair, saying that, like, I loved education, I loved studying and I loved kind of like school and stuff, but being out of education, the world is your oyster. I know it sounds really cliche, but I've been able to do some amazing things in my life. Like, I got to travel and I was 25 when I set up my business. So I was quite young. Like, I'd left EY and I was in and out of like working in different nursery settings for about 6 months. And then I was like, this is what I want to do. And I managed to find the niche and at 25 managed to set up my business. So I was very lucky, I think. But yeah, I've learned a lot of skills at university and through education in general that I use a lot in business, which is interesting.
Yeah, it is good. As in, I do get a bit confused as to whether people really need to go to university, especially now that fees are like so much more expensive. And if you think about the money you spend on it versus you could be earning money in a job where you're also learning just as much stuff. It's, I don't know if you really need it.
Well, so yeah, I probably agree. Like, I'm in the process of hiring an apprentice at the moment. And I just think, I think whatever your path is, whatever you feel that you should want to do, that's what you should do. Like, if you feel like I want to go into education, I want to go to university and I want to kind of learn, carry on doing that. But if that's not your path, it's not the end of the world. Like, everyone's like, you should get.
But as in, you might feel that way because society tells you that like a successful person must go to university to become like a real person.
But then you look at Richard Branson and people, it's not always the case. Like,
no. And I enjoyed my degree, but actually it sort of was a bit distracting once I was running my business and I probably could have done a better job of what I was doing otherwise. And still a bit of a debate as to whether it was that.
Yeah. And I think I think because what I did kind of leads in what I do in business. So mine was like a really nice foundation. Because like I learned a lot about like Ofsted regulations and kind of like, which I use pretty much every single day in my business. Like all kind of like the rights of children, what they're entitled to, like in terms of like kind of health and safety and things like that. I learned all of that at university. So I was able to use that in my business. So I was very fortunate that like my mum's been a teacher for 25 years. So when I was deciding my degree, she was just like, whatever you do, just do something you love. Just do something you love. And then it'll all come easy and you'll find something. And I think now she's a life coach. So she's kind of like guided me through my life, literally. So I managed to find something I was super passionate about and I made it into a business. So it's really cool. Because what we do is that we're the first company in the UK to provide it to corporates, mobile childcare. So well, there's no one else out there that was doing it at the time. So
it also goes into the whole, have you heard of like the mastery thing? As in like this sort of, in your early 20s, you should kind of just go for like different experiences and try and like collect different things. And then you'll have like this collection of different skill sets that you can combine into one thing. And so you studied like psychology and developmental psychology, then you worked in corporates. And then like, who knows how to like build a business for like kids in corporates and things, which like just no one had really seen before. But suddenly you kind of have these different things.
And it's amazing how much people realize that. Because like, I'll go into like large organizations, corporate companies, and the way that I like write my emails or put a PowerPoint presentation together, they can tell that I've been like, been in the corporate world a little bit.
Yeah.
Whilst a lot of people who have been in like, working with children or in the education kind of sector tend to either kind of start straight out of school or like go into university and go like do their PGCE and then go into like kind of like a school setting. So they don't really have that corporate experience. So when they kind of meet me, they're just a bit like, I can't really put you into a box. Are you corporate? Are you childcare? Are you? So it's nice. I think I've been very fortunate to have like experience in both worlds, which is, yeah, which is great.
Yeah, people should be putting people into boxes.
That is very true.
Yeah.
But that's not society also, unfortunately.
Definitely true. Kind of silly. Interesting. So how long were you at EY for? And what?
So I was at EY for just over 3 years. Mm. I was a tax consultant there. So I left.
How did you get into tax consultancy from developmental psychology? That's like a big jump.
So I did. So my second year, I applied for the internship there in to the tax department. And I think what it was is that I liked the idea of their graduate scheme and their kind of like the way that they kind of like almost like spoon fed you to a certain extent. Like they brought you on, you're all part of a cohort, you went through your exams together, you learned, you went into like different areas and departments. So I was like, I think that's quite a nice structure for me. So I did maths A-level, always loved maths, like working with numbers and things like that. So I was like, actually just read up a little bit about it. And I was like, oh, I'm going to apply for the internship. Did the internship my second year of Gulf University. Absolutely loved it. Everyone was like, you're a child psychologist. But then saying that, like the two other grads that were in my team, one did geography and the other one did, I think it was physics. So no one really does. I think they're looking more for the kind of the softer skills that we can teach you on the job.
Yeah.
So yeah, so then got offered a job as soon straight out of university in out of third year, decided that I started panicking about life and I was like, I don't want to go to the corporate world and like start my adult life yet. So I deferred my place and then worked in investment banking. So I worked for 6 months.
I went to India. That's where the India story will be. No, investment.
Not yet.
What?
Not yet.
Didn't want to do corporate, so I went into investment banking.
So yeah, I went into investment banking.
That's like a me story.
So yeah, I did 3 months at BNP Paribas and 3 months at Macquarie. And then I did my traveling of like classic kind of like South America, China kind of thing. Yeah. So then came back and decided, right, that's the time that I'm going to start at EY, started my like all my exams. And then kind of when I finished all my exams, my like tax exams, got all the experience I felt like I could out of there, I left and I was like, right, I'm going to leave. And everyone was like, oh, so you're going to go to another big four? And I was like, no, I'm actually going to go set up a nursery. They were like, oh, okay, a bit different. So yeah, that's how I kind of started to do what I do. Really?
Mm. So did you already kind of have a very clear idea of what the business model will be having been in corporates? Was it like, I just feel like running a nursery and then you happen to then start doing it and then realize you could take it to where you took it?
Yeah. With business, I think for me, I had to really adapt my business model every single step of the way. So I left EY being like, I'm going to set up my own children's nursery, like a permanent children's nursery. So I started working as a manager in one of the large nursery chains franchise and started like putting a business plan together, kind of working out how I would do it. Would I lease the building? Would I buy the building? Et cetera, et cetera. And I was just like, this is a massive capital investment. Can I not make this mobile? Because I think what happened was a lot of my friends, so like at EY, a lot of us work from home. A lot of us have flexi working. Like we no longer really have that 9-to-5 corporate job. Why is childcare not moved on? I was like, can I not make this mobile and go to settings and provide childcare to parents wherever they are and make it more accessible to people? So I kind of looked into the business like model of that. And how I actually won my first client was actually the George Club, which is one of the Barclay Group. It's like a members club in Mayfair. I literally walked in and was like, this is what I do. And I have, at this time, I had a few clients, but this was my first corporate client. So I had about 20, 30 kind of events I'd already previously done, but this is my first corporate client. I was like, this is what I do. I'd love to just kind of provide mobile childcare downstairs whilst your members are like dining upstairs. And they were like, right, we'll give you a go. And they gave me a go and they loved our service. And then they signed our contract within a couple of weeks. And then from there, it kind of just, we worked with more and more members clubs. And then actually someone was like, well, why don't you pop up in shared workspaces? How about like providing shared works childcare over like school holidays, May half term, summer holidays? We'll provide you with like a meeting room and just provide like a mobile activity day for children. So then I popped up at the office group, WeWork, and then it just expanded and it's just gone like a bit crazy and gone out of control really.
Cool. So on any given day, like how many things do you have like popped up?
It depends on like the time of the year and when it is. So like during kind of Monday to Friday, it's technically be like more office based, just sorting out events, working things. We'll occasionally have like one or two, like we do a lot of graduations, kind of popping up for graduations or like conferences or things like that. So we'll probably have one or two during the week and then we'll probably have like four or five at the weekend. And then over like school holidays, we can have up to 3, 4, 5 settings being popped up at different locations.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's very different.
Yeah, yeah. That's really, sounds like you've kind of solved like a real problem.
And I think what I've found from parents is that they either can't get to work in time in the morning because they're dropping off children, school, nursery, etc., or they have to leave work early to go pick them up. And we wanted to solve the issue of, like, we can be there, you can come down. So a lot of our activity days, the parents can come down and actually have lunch with their child and then go pick up.
Yeah,
so they get to have the train journey in together, they get to, like, have lunch together, and then they have, like, the train journey home together, and they absolutely love it. They say it's like an invaluable experience that they can just know that they're on site and they're safe. So
it's nice. For the very first one, how did you put the plan together of what you'd actually do with the children and what you'd have?
At that point, I'd worked in about so many settings. I had about 7 years of kind of experience with children of all different ages. So I kind of know what children like to do, what activities they like, what will keep them entertained, things like that. Every single setup, we have a different theme. So we have arts and crafts going on. We have, like, mini Olympics. We have, like, forest fun. We have cooking days. We have chocolate making. We have science experiments. We make slime. With our business model, we are a unique blend of childcare and entertainment. So we are all staff are, like, qualified nannies, but we all do entertainment. So we keep them entertained and learning and having fun whilst making sure that, like, health and safety and their primary care is looked after too.
Yeah, it sounds like lots of fun. I'm like, where did I get this when I was a kid?
Awesome. Slime making. We should have done some slime making part of the podcast.
Yeah.
I should have brought it in. We could have done one of my arts and crafts activities that we do with children.
Next time.
Podcast two, round two.
Well, that sounds pretty awesome. Pretty excited for the idea of having a kid and just being able to leave them somewhere like where I'm actually.
You could just come drop them off anytime with us.
Yeah. Nice. So this has only been London so far?
No, we are throughout Europe. What we tend to do abroad is weddings. So we've popped up in Tuscany, Portugal, Turkey. So with those, we'll provide, like, it tends to be like a large Indian wedding or kind of where there's like a couple of days of events, and we'll set up like a creche facility for 3 or 4 days for those, the bride and groom and their children. So yeah, we'll go internationally for, like, weddings.
Cool. How did you work out how to price it?
Just, like, based on what the childcare is. I know that the average price of childcare in terms of, like, running a nursery, it's like a balancing act of knowing what the parents want to do and then knowing that it's convenient and on site, and just kind of finding, like, a warm-up kind of figure.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of worth a bit more than just a normal nursery because you have to go and do the faff part yourself.
Yeah. But saying that, we're actually on par or cheaper than quite a lot of the nurseries. We find that when I go into corporations, they try and subsidize for their employees or their members as well. So it's, like, almost even cheaper. Like, some of our spaces, we pay like £40 a day for their childcare for the entire day, which is very cheap for someone that probably doesn't have a child. You have no idea what that means.
I mean, it sounds like if I wanted to look at, like, just a babysitter, they're going to be like £20 an hour or something.
Well, a good one is, I would say, about £12 to £15 an hour. So yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, so that means, so how many kind of kids can you take in a nursery?
Independent on the space. So we've done up to 60 at one point.
Yeah, wow.
But it just depends. I wanted to keep our model as flexible as possible. So I want to, like, move around whatever the client's needs are. So if that means they want, like, 6 children for 3 hours, we can do that. If they want 60 children for 3 weeks, we can do that too. So we do different age groups. We start from 6 months up to 12 years, but we just make sure that we cater to whatever the client needs. We try and keep it as flexible as possible because that's why I set up. The reason why I set up is that I want to be able to cater to any parent's need that they want. Yeah, it's great what I do. I love it. So wouldn't change it for the world.
Yeah, no, that's really nice. So how did you go about finding the people that you employed? Do you sort of recruit friends directly? How do you interview people?
Yeah, so I think in our industry, it's quite like everyone really knows everyone. A lot of it was from word of mouth, just going out and kind of being like, oh, this one of my teachers are really interested in this, or actually this person's interested. And then I face-to-face interview all my staff. So we have over 50 nannies now that kind of run our books, like, working. And yeah, I've interviewed every single one of them. They're all, like, DBS checked, first aid trained. We'll make sure that really kind of, like, got thorough experience. And if we're catering to a client that's got babies, then we'll make sure that we bring in the staff that have got, like, that age group experience. So yeah, a lot of it's just word of mouth, really.
Cool. Anyway, it does sound like a lot of fun, and I'm pretty happy this exists for just my future life, which I'm kind of feeling will probably be chaotic, and hopefully with kids we will see. So I guess the channel I sort of really want to talk about, and that just sounds nuts, what made you decide to do that, and is it worth just backtracking to all the charity things first?
I think so.
Let's do that. So we go to the India stuff where you discovered problems?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
So as you probably could tell from my surname, I'm of Indian heritage. So I was born in the UK. My mum moved from India when she was 6 months. My dad is a full-on Geordie, born in Newcastle, thick Geordie accent. His name is Jeffrey. At the age of about 7, I went back to India, went to Delhi. And I was just taken back. I remember one particular scene where I was in a car and I was at a traffic set of traffic light, and I was sitting there with my mum next to me and my dad next to her, and this little girl came and knocked on the window, and she was so disheveled, matted hair, ripped clothes, and then she had like a little sister on her arm, and she was just like knocking on our car window, like gesturing for food, like really hungry. You could just see her bones. And for me, that really just took me back. I looked at my mum and I just started crying, and I was just like, why is my life so different? I'm Indian. Just because of what my grandparents did and moving over to England, because their teachers, they were kind of the shortage of teachers, they kind of moved over. Why is my life so different? Why does she have to be there and I have to be here? Why am I on the side of the window and why is she there? And I was just like, I need to do something. I have to do something. But I was 7. Like, what could I do? And I just thought, she goes out every day and like helps her sister and goes out to get food with her mum and dad. What can I do to like sacrifice something? And being 7, I was like, what is the most important thing to me in the world? And I was like, chocolate sweets and like fizzy drinks. So I was like, I'm going to give it up. I'm going to give up for an entire year. So I decided to come home and I was like, I'm going to sacrifice something. I'm going to put myself in their shoes, like understand their kind of way of living. Not that is any comparison, but like for me, it was like a thing that I felt like I could do. So I went back to school and I spoke about what I did and why I've decided to do it. And like people were like, why are you not eating chocolate? Why are you not eating sweets? And I told them the story. And from that, I actually raised money, because people were like, I want to give you money so you can go back and kind of like give some money to the charity or whatever, whoever you decide. So at 7, I actually raised £1,000, which is quite a lot for a 7-year-old. And I went back to India like a couple of years later, and I went to a school for blind children and bought them like some braille books and some supplies and things like that. Like, obviously you're not going to go overly far in like a massive school. So that's kind of how my journey started. That's like my first experience of charity work and giving back. And having heard about my business and what I've done, it's kind of almost been something that's stayed with me in my entire life. Like, I still work with children now, always trying to like give back as much as I can with children. So yeah, so from there, I just carried on doing voluntary work. I went out to Sri Lanka when there was a tsunami. I went and worked in lived in a local home in Sri Lanka and worked in an orphanage of children whose parents had passed away through the tsunami. I've always felt that I've been very blessed with life and the situation I've been born into. Any aspect I can, I really do try and give back. My like philosophy on life is like, any person I interact with, I want them to feel a little bit happier or a little bit better, or just to know that if I interact with anyone, kind of motivated them to do something. I think that's all I kind of wanted to do. So yeah, that's where it kind of all started, really.
Yeah, really nice. It's good to see people actually doing things actively, because I really believe in, like, if you think that you want to be a kind person, just be kind the whole time.
Yeah. And do you know what? Giving back, just smile at someone that looks sad, or just walk on the street and like give a homeless person a coffee. I try every day just do one thing that just makes someone happy in that day. That pass forward kind of mentality of like, if I do something to you, you may do something else that may actually save someone's life. Like, you don't know where that's going to end up. And I think that's the mentality I like to have on a day-to-day basis, really.
Yeah, it's cool, because yeah, you never know how stuff's going to really affect people. And I really like in asking people what's the kindest thing someone's done for them, because it kind of just gives you like a whole set of things that people have perceived as really kind. And when you then have the opportunity to do the thing that they just told you about, you notice it more, because you're like, oh, I might actually just make someone's day right now. And sure, maybe like 5 times out of 6, like it doesn't make that much of a difference in their life, but it might just be like the best thing that's ever happened to them. And you can't really tell until you've done it. And so it's sort of worth.
Yeah. Things. Do you know what? It's not directly impacting me, but it was one of the kindest things I've ever witnessed for me. So at the time, I think I went back to India when I was about 12 or 13. And I went to go stay with some family who are still there, who are now moved over to Edinburgh. And I was staying with them. And so I went to a project where children had been kind of like
institutionalized.
Anyway, they've been put into this kind of like home shelter because they've either got some sort of mental, like either depression or something that's very curable, but they've been kind of like put into these like homes and things, and they want to be like disowned and if they've gone mad and things like that. So I went in and I saw some of the really, really sad cases, and we were coming out, and next door there's like an adult wing, and we came out and there was this lady that came like running to the gate. I was with my auntie, and she was like shaking on the gate, like violently shaking, like her hair had like, she had like cut her hair off, obviously herself. You could see that, just sprouts of hair everywhere. And she was like shaking, like she obviously, there was something wrong. She was like shaking and shaking and violently shaking this gate. And my auntie like looked at her and then looked back to me, and I was only quite young, so I was a bit like, don't go over to her, like don't even try. And looked at me, and then she looked at her, and then she looked back to me, and then she walked over to this lady, and I was like, oh my gosh, she's gonna go over to her, she's gonna let her out. oh, she's going to do something really scary. And the lady turned around and like said my auntie's name. And I was like, what? They know each other? And she was like, yeah, yeah. They started having a conversation to learn like Hindi. And after this conversation, the exchange of words, they like embraced like through a gate and like kind of smiled and cried. And then they got into the car and I turned around to my auntie and was like, what was that? Like, what's going on? She goes, that is the daughter-in-law of the lady that lives next to me. And I was like, why is she in there? She goes, she had postnatal depression and they thought she was mad. So they put her in this institute and they've left her in there and she was crying and she was banging on these doors and gates because she said, they've taken my baby away from me. She's just driven herself mad. I get emotional about these things. So I went mental. And I was like, you need to go over to their house. You need to tell your neighbor, like, get her back. Da, 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 da. And like in the Indian community, like, you don't get involved in other people's business. Like, shh, mental health. Like, let's not speak about it. Da, da, da. And after about 2 days of persistence, my auntie just like went down and like broke down. Was just like, I'm going to do something. And this was one of the kindest acts. She like put herself out there. She went round. She knocked on the door and she sat down. It was like, look, just spoke to her and was like, she just needs support and love from the family. And I just witnessed it because they actually spoke in English and I witnessed it. And I was just like, the compassion and love that she gave, that she was like, she's going to be fine. She'll be okay. And I actually had to leave the next day. And like all the time I was calling up, being like, what's going on? What's going on? They've got her out. They've got her out. And about 2 months later, after a bit of like, kind of like help when she was in the kind of the institute, she came out and now she's back living with her husband and her child. And that was only because of my auntie who convinced her neighbor to be like, come on, this is not a big thing. Mental health, this happens to people. And it was one of the kindest acts I've ever seen because do you know what? You've changed not only that child's life, the mother's life and everyone around her. So yeah, I think that's one of the kindest acts. Because I was bugging her so much. But yeah, it was an incredible story. So yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Do you think that sort of affected you quite a lot in terms of just the impact that someone can have when they bother to do things?
It's just a simple conversation, really. Like, I know it was a massive thing in like the scale of things, but I think the neighbor just wanted reassurance that everything was going to be okay. And she had lost her husband and she was like, I don't know if I can take on a daughter-in-law that wasn't quite stable, and she just didn't know what to do and she was a bit lost. And I think just going over that, have a simple conversation and a couple of months of support and she was back on her feet. So it's small things, small steps, but they make a world of difference. So yeah, I think that's one of the kindest acts I've kind of been part of, kind of.
Cool. That's a good story. Okay. Then, so did you do a lot of other fundraising and stuff before you got to doing the channel then, I guess?
Yeah, so I think how my story kind of carried on from there, I kind of continued to do charity work through like school and education. Like I mentioned, I went to Sri Lanka. I kind of volunteered at like special needs schools and things like that. And then when I was around 20, I decided to run the London Marathon. And I ran the London Marathon for UNICEF and I raised £11,000 for them. And it was a challenging kind of ordeal. But actually, after I did that, I kind of just moved on very quickly. And I kind of did the marathon, gave the money and kind of was like, yeah, fine, done. And I think I was searching for the next thing. And I just didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I felt like I needed a bit of inspiration. So again, where all inspiration comes from is India in my case. So I was speaking to a few charities here that did like partnerships with India. And I came across the British Asia Trust, which is a trust founded by Prince Charles, who helps South Asian countries kind of in loads of different aspects of his education, kind of just like health and kind of well-being. And one of the projects we were speaking about was this project in Mumbai called the Prerna Project. And I was like, right, I wanted to see what happens. Like, they seem like an amazing kind of cause. And so I flew out to Mumbai and I met one of the ladies who runs the project. And what they did is they support women and girls who have been sold by their own families into prostitution, the sex slave industry, as young as 8, 9. Been sold by their own fathers, their own uncles, and they all lived in this brothel. So when I arrived, I was like, I need to go into these places. I need to go into these kind of like these brothels, these in this kind of where they're all kind of situated. So they were like, are you really sure about this, Leah? And I was like, yeah, no, I need to witness it firsthand. I need to see what's going on, what's happening. They took me in and I just can't even describe the surroundings. It was like rat infested. There was no sanitary. There was no water. There was no lighting, no electricity, just kind of like room on room on room, broken stairs. Like, it was just horrendous. I walked upstairs, went to one of the rooms. I went into this room, worked out afterwards that this room was the same size as a UK prison cell. So just to put it into mind, kind of like that's the size of how big it was. And there was these three benches. All of these three benches were in this room. And they were like raised on these like stilts. And like underneath these benches were like all of their belongings, like all their pots and pans, all their clothes, like everything. So their whole life was on this one bench with all their stuff underneath. And they were all these three women were sitting on these benches like beaten, like bruised. Like they were soulless. Like you looked at these people and they were just soulless. They had like just given up on life. It was just heartbreaking. It was just unimaginable. Like these people lived in these conditions. I remember one of the questions, I was with the social worker at the time, and one of the questions I asked was this, like, there was like numeral kind of like, you know, like tallying, like in carved tallying on the side of one of the, on the door frame that they'd like carved out, like 1, 2, 3, 5, like crossed it out. And I was like, what is this? Like, why is there tallies on? And the social worker turned around to me and was like, the pimps, the people who bring in the clients, said, they tell the women, the young women, the girls, that they've got to do a certain amount of sexual activities, be with certain men, and then they'll get released. But every day they change the purple, every day they change the target. So they're so psychologically like brainwashed, and like I'm like every day this target's moved. So they're aiming for something, they're aiming for their 20 men or et cetera, 20 clients, but every day it's moved. So they're just so psychologically messed up. And it was just horrible to see, like, there was no windows in these rooms. Like, they had been beaten and bruised. I was at this point nearly in tears. And I was there. And then all of a sudden, all of these children came running in. And I was like, what is going on? Like, where have these children come from? What's happened? And the lady turned, like, the social worker turned around to me and was like, these are the children of these women. And they were like half Chinese, half English, half of them were the pimps' children, like all different ethnicities, different backgrounds. And they were like, oh, I was like, okay, what's going on? And these children would crawl under these beds and like sit under these benches. And I was like, what are they doing under there? They're like, that's where they sleep. That's where they live. So they live under these benches whilst their mothers perform sexual activities to clients above whilst they're sleeping with pots and pans. They could have up to three children under that plank, under that bench. Mm-hmm. And at this point, I had studied childhood studies for 3 years at university. I had witnessed so many children in different situations. Mm-hmm. And I'm not living in a world where this happens. I just can't. I was just so heartbroken. So that was like my biggest catalyst. I was like, what the hell am I going to do? So I came back and I thought for like a couple of months and I was like, what do I do? Do I do this? Do I do that? In the 21st century, I feel like people have charity fatigue. I think people are a bit like, oh my God, right? Another marathon, another 10K, another 5K. So I want to do something so ridiculous that people are like, right, what the hell? Why are you doing this? Like, are you crazy? Like, you must be mental to do this. So I was like, right, why can't I swim from England to another country? Like, why can't I do this? And I just researched it. And I think I'd heard a few people kind of maybe attempting it. I didn't really know anyone personally that had done it. And I found out there was the Channel Swimming Association, and there wasn't actually a governing body that organizes these swims, and there's pilots and there's training plans. And I was like, right, that's it. I'm going to swim the English Channel. And I decided, and that was literally the reason why I did it. And my parents do not forgive me till this day. No, I'm joking. so that was the reason why I decided to swim the English Channel.
That's awesome
that you swam the English Channel. The rest of it, not so awesome. But yeah, how do you go about raising money? How did you get like 170,000? Like, who did you go to do that?
Because
as your mates, then who else gives you money?
So yeah, it's quite an unusual story. So I actually was very lucky that I had my story and I kind of understood why I was going to do it. And when I was very clear about what I wanted to do, I just spoke. I spoke from the heart. I showed pictures to people. I was like, this is what's going on, da, da, da. And it was very organic. Like, it was these silly little things. Like, when you talk about it, when you're passionate about something, I went to the doctors, okay? And one of the side effects of swimming channels and doing this kind of stuff, you get quite sick and you get stings all over your arms from jellyfish, da, da, da. So I just went for a general checkup to be like, swimming the English Channel, just to let, like, am I alive and everything going well? And my doctor was like, what's going on? Like, why have you got so many cuts, like jelly stings, and like, what's like going on with your stomach? And I was like, well, actually, I'm training to swim the English Channel. And he was like, what? He was like, why are you doing it? And we just got talking and like things like that. He donated the next day. And I think when you go out and speak about things, and I was just like, this is why I'm doing it. I was very fortunate that I raised for that project £50,000, and that was just organic. I just went out and I just spoke about why I was doing it and how I did it and what the ordeal of actually swimming the channel entails. Because I think a lot of people are quite naive to that. So the Channel Swimming Association, which is like the governing body, has really strict rules. One of which, you have to wear a swimsuit, you can't wear a wetsuit, because it has to be as authentic as a first ever swimmer.
Jeez, must be cold.
Oh, I gained 24 pounds over the space of like 18 months to insulate myself. Last time I checked, it was about 11 people have died swimming the channel, of which most of them was because of hypothermia.
Next month, and I am thinking I might like do a month of just eating McDonald's or something.
You're going to freeze. It's cold.
It is.
It's cold. So yeah, the water was about 13, 14 degrees.
Yeah, and that's super cold. I remember I used to do a lot of kayaking, and as soon as it got below like 10 degrees, when you sort of went underwater for a bit and came back out, you just always get brain freeze.
Yeah.
But I capsized when it was like middle of winter, like ice everywhere, and the water was like 3 degrees, and I got pinned against the bridge, and I had to like get out. And literally, I swam about 5 seconds and just like everything just stopped moving. Yeah, I just floated long enough for the kayak instructor to come and like fish me out.
Sugar.
I would just totally died if he hadn't have got me. Because I was swimming, and just
you
nothing
just
happened.
Freeze up, right?
Like, yeah, yeah. Everything just stopped moving. It was like, well, I've got adrenaline, but it's not doing anything. Well, I'm just sitting here like, I can't move.
It's really interesting because like it's not only the fact that it's cold; it's the amount of hours that you're in that water. Mm. It took me 14 hours and 44 minutes.
Oh, nice.
So that means you're not only in the water for that period; you're cold and you're not eating. I had no solid foods. You don't eat any solid foods on that period. The way that they like hydrate you or give you any form of like nutrition is they get these bottles and they tie like a dog lead around them, and then they like throw them out to you, and then they let you down your shot, and then they'll just reel it in like a dog lead. So yeah, it's the combination of all of those that you have to factor in when doing all your planning meals and training. And yeah, it's very intense. So yeah, that was, you meant, sorry, I've got off the topic about how did you raise the money. So 50,000 was for that. And then after that, I raised 100,000 for cancer research. In total was 155,000. So 105 for the first and then 50 for the other. And then in total was 170 for my life kind of thing.
Yeah.
And my dad was diagnosed with chronic lymphatic leukemia about 3 years ago now. And it was just the witnessing of him just deteriorating and being really unwell, and witnessing firsthand him going through chemotherapy and then finding out his cancer's like incurable. And it was just that whole experience of going through that and seeing it firsthand and knowing that one in two people get some sort of cancer in their life. So between me and you, one of us statistically will get cancer in our lives at some point, which is quite scary. So with that, actually, with that, the £105,000 I think it was £100,000 that I raised on that night, I actually just did a dinner. So I did a dinner. I had about 40 people actually in the room, of my really, really close, my parents, close friends and family. And I got up and I just spoke about my dad for the first ever time. And my dad had just finished chemotherapy and none of my family and friends knew. And I just cried and cried. And I think it was just very authentic. And within about 10 minutes, I'd raised £100,000. I just can't even put into words the support I had. So yeah, so I just spoke very authentically and about the reasons why I wanted to do it. And I think that's also, knowing your why is also a massive driver when you're in that water 4 hours and you can't keep going. And remembering those children's faces or my dad going through chemo just helped me get along, really.
Wow. So when people donate for cancer research, you were still saying that you're going to be touring the channel for this?
So what I did is I promised the Prerna project, which is the project out in Mumbai, £50,000.
Yeah.
So I gave them their £50,000, but the money kept coming in. And what I did with that £50,000 is they provided a shelter next door to the brothel. So the children now live in this shelter next door. So they don't have to witness their mothers being abused. So they go from school to the shelter, to the shelter to the school. And the mothers will come and visit them in the shelters. It's not like a solution to the problem, but it's provides them a safe haven of not being able to having to witness that every day and things like that. So I promised them £50,000. So I gave them that. And then when I finished that, I said, look, I've kind of hit my target and people have been really supportive. And I've decided now that I wanted to I wanted to do something in the UK. So I raised it for Cancer Research UK. And yeah, so I decided to start raising funds for them, which was the remaining amount. So yeah, it was very, very exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty epic. Definitely. Pretty inspiring tale of like just making shit happen when you see a problem.
Yeah.
Rather than being like
I think I'm just too much of an emotional person. I think that's what it is. It leads me to these kind of situations.
That's good. It's really impressive. Yeah. Feel a bit inept now.
Don't.
Cool. So how did you like Did people kind of expect to be coming to donate money when you had this dinner, or was it just...
No, it wasn't a fundraiser. It was just a dinner to tell people what I did. Because I think when I decided to send the channel, I was the first, as I said, I was the first British Asian woman. So in like the Asian society, like we don't really have swimmers. Like we have cricket players, good at cricket players as Indians, but we don't really have swimmers. So no one had really even heard of the concept. So I kind of wanted to just kind of explain to them kind of what the training involved, like the fact that I had to like put on 22 pounds, like I lost so much hair, like clumps and clumps
really?
Hair from the chlorine. Yeah. Like I was up for the last 2 months, I was up crying pretty much every night because my body was so seized up.
Yeah.
Like the nutritional kind of implications of it, like I was taking supplements, like I think it was like 12 supplements a day. Like I was I was on like 3,000 calories. I was like constantly eating. I was in the pool, out the pool, open water, cold water. So I just wanted to explain everyone, like, so they just were part of my journey. Like, this is what I'm doing. This is kind of why I'm doing it. Like, it was more kind of just an informative dinner than it was a fundraiser. And it just happened that someone just randomly, one of my uncles got up and was like, I'm going to donate this. And then the person next to him was like, I'm going to donate this. And it just kind of, it was really, it was like such a surreal experience. I was like, within like 10 minutes, I was like, what is going on? Like, what? Where is this money come from? Like, it was phenomenal. It was phenomenal.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Maybe I'd go to one of your
fundraisers. Yeah, my dinners.
So I'll come have a dinner. Yeah, sure.
I don't know what's going to happen out of this. So, yeah.
So, that's cool. Still, have you had any other friends do similar things because of you, do you feel? Or still feel quite like...
They haven't done similar things, but I've always said, like, I was mental to size of a channel, right? Mm. So it was a bit of a ludicrous. I think when anyone kind of does something like this, or anyone starts up a business, like we mentioned kind of earlier, I think everyone's got to have a slight kind of naivety to it, like slightly crazy. Because I think if you actually knew the full extent of what's going to happen, what you're about to put yourself in for, then you would not do it. So I don't sit down and I kind of talk to people about my story to be like, you should swim a channel, you should start a business, or you should da da da. I just want them to do something that they potentially wouldn't have done if they hadn't had a conversation, or like we had a sat down on a conversation. So like for me, things that have really inspired me since I've kind of done the channel that I've heard of, like my little cousin, who's like, I think she's like a 10, like heard my story of my swim, and she decided to like give up chocolate for a year. And like, that was really sweet, because that for her, that was really big. And like, that's a channel for her. And like one of my uncles came up to me and was like, oh, I was in the gym the other day and I was on the treadmill and I had run about 20 minutes and I was about to stop. And I looked down at the clock and I was like, Leah has swum for 14 hours and 44 minutes. I can run for another 10 minutes. So like, I was like, yeah, like good on you. Mm. If you feel like that's inspired you to run another 10 minutes and you feel a bit healthier and happier. So it's those small things that really make an impact on my life. Cause like, I don't want people going out swimming the channel if they don't want to. Like, if that's your dream, good on you. But like, if it means that you're going to spend 10 minutes on the treadmill, 10 extra minutes on the treadmill, or you're going to like do something that's a big little change in your life, then that's enough for me to be able to be like, I feel like I've achieved something to help you. So yeah, I think those little things are probably more so than big challenges out of my friends and family's group.
Yeah, it's really nice to see that you've been having an effect. So yeah. It's really cool when you change other people, because whatever you're doing, it's sort of, it seems kind of normal, even though it might be crazy in some ways. But then when the other people go and do things, like, wow, I didn't make that happen. It happened without me, kind of just sort of because of me, but not me doing it. It's really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when I was training with swimmers who had like done a lot of long distance swimming, like not all of them had done the channel, but a lot of them had done long distance swimming. So when I was in that little bubble, which I pretty much isolated myself about 3 months prior to the swim, like I went to work and I swam. I'd gained so much weight and lost a lot of confidence and I didn't really want to go out and socialize and things. You get put in this little bubble of like, the channel's a normal thing, right? Like, and I'm like, we'll go out and I'll talk about it as if like, it's like, oh yeah, I'm just going to pop to the shops. Like, I'm just going to swim the channel next week. Like, I'm going off this tide. And my family and friends are like, what the hell is going on? Like, what? Like, this is... So I think it's nice. It's quite refreshing to like be surrounded by friends and family who bring you down to reality and be like, this is a bit ludicrous. Like, you need to be really careful and you need to like... So yeah, it's nice to have a balance of the both, because if you had that all the time, I think I would drive myself insane. That I'd be like, I can't achieve this. But I had the support and confidence from my swimmers as well. So it's good.
Cool. So what's next?
If I had a £5, everyone asked me that, I would raise another £150,000. So I think one of the things I kind of touched on earlier is that when I ran the marathon, I just moved on to the next thing, my next inspiration, it was my next thing to do. And actually, having swam the Channel, I took some time to reflect on myself and where I wanted to go in life and what I wanted to do and how I wanted to make an impact. And I realized that life is a lot more than just me as an individual and rates fundraising and kind of, especially on this journey where I realized there were so many, okay, I might have got in and swam the Channel, but there's so many other elements that people don't see. Like people are like being like, you've done this, you've done amazing, getting all the praise. But actually behind me was my support boat, my trainer, my mum and dad, who had to put up with my hellish behavior for like 10 months, if not more, 27 years. But like, I realized that life is more than just an individual. So I decided that from now I want to go out and tell my story. I want to go out and have that kind of rippling effect of like, if I go out and speak to you and you speak to 5 people, I've impacted 6 people, and you may raise money or give to charitable givings or volunteer. But do you know what? If I've inspired 6 people between the six, all of us, we're going to do so much more in the world than if I sat here and tried to do it myself. So now I think my ambition is just to kind of go out and speak to people about my journey, speak about what I've done. What can you do? How can you achieve your goals? Like, what do you want to do in your life? So I decided I've started writing a children's book, which is hopefully going to be out in July on my anniversary, just about like what I've done, like how my journey started when I was 7 and how I ran the marathon and kind of swam the Channel and what I did and my mindset through it. And it's just a children's book to make them realize kind of you can achieve anything. It may not be voluntary work. It may be not charitable giving, but I don't want them to ever lose that sense of like the sky is the limit. You can achieve anything. Because I think in a world where we do have social media and we have kind of people around us that are like making their lives look amazing and like to a certain extent that children can get disheartened. So I think now my next project is to inspire the next generation. I think that's what I want to do.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's nice. So you clearly have a very good growth mindset, which is fantastic. Just what we would like to hear. What do you think would be your one take-home message, or do you think you basically summed it up? This is, you can do whatever you can do, or do you think you could word that better?
No, so I think my biggest thing I've learned in life in general is like anything that you want to achieve is not like everyone, quite a lot of people have spoken to me in the sense that like you've done a massive physical challenge or swimming the Channel, you've run the marathon, da, 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 da. But swimming the English Channel was 50% mental and 50% physical. Don't get me wrong, it was a massive physical feat. And it just makes me realize the importance of mindset and having kind of like that I can attitude and that kind of that amazing quote that he who says he can and he who says he can't are both usually right. And just remembering that and like when you're going to fail, life's going to throw you crap. You're good, like things going to happen. You are going to fail. So it's at that point, sitting down and reflecting what's going right and what's going wrong and just persistence. Just like keep going and having that I can attitude will get you so much further in life than you can even articulate to someone. So yeah, it's I think all about mindset and getting your mind kind of into that I can attitude.
Awesome. That's perfectly summed up for a good ending. we've already discussed the kinds of things that happened to you and your favorite thing. Kind of also discussed early memories. That's another thing I really like to ask people, as in your most distinct early memory, but perhaps your one really counts. Have you got any others that sort of like?
So I've got the earliest memory is not really that. It's not really like changed my life or anything, but one of my memories is I remember when I was like, I think I was about 3 or 4, and I went to school and in our school photos, I don't even know if this animal cruelty now, but our logo of like our school used to be an owl. So my earliest memory is when I was like 3, I think it was. And I remember taking my school photo with this like massive owl that's like literally bigger than me. I think that's probably my earliest memory. Wow.
Sounds kind of scary.
It wasn't really changing my life. But yeah. That's my earliest memory. So yeah. But
Cool. Okay, is there any questions you'd like to ask me?
What was the most surprising thing that you came out of this podcast?
I think I kind of found my own voice, as in, so that you've been talking about the things that you've done, and I think it does make a lot of sense that where you're going, I think you could go do a lot more with, if you could document what you'd done better, if you'd sort of recorded some of what you'd done on for like a TV episode or something, you could have had like a really big effect. And that, I think I've learned to get better explaining my story so that people can buy into them, and like the confidence to speak as well. So when I first started, it took me 9 months before I could actually record the intro or outro to an episode. I couldn't like phone my friends and leave a voicemail, that kind of thing. And I had to force myself to leave just voice messages on WhatsApp for a month, and I wouldn't let myself text, kind of thing, just to like make myself do it. So that was like the first part. Then by the second year, I did some podcasts just by myself where I recorded my voice. And by the third year, I didn't have a podcast ready one day, and so I just said some shit for like 10 minutes. And then literally I did that 3 weeks in a row because I had some problems. And then I got invited to do a TED speech on that stuff that I'd spoken about.
Wow,
that
just came out the top of my brain. Congratulations.
But I've ended up now doing like stand-up comedy, and I've just done like a bunch of Toastmasters for the past month. I've been giving like a speech basically every day. And so I went from being like this person that couldn't give speeches and was super awkward to like, oh, I'm giving TED speeches and doing stand-up comedy and things. And I've just been most surprised by myself, I guess, by like having the growth mindset and kind of pushing myself into things I couldn't do. Mm. Although I've had some amazing stories and stuff I didn't expect as well. And like, you've been pretty inspiring. Cause I've, like you said about like can-do attitudes and things that are holding you back, I definitely have had some things holding me back still. As in, people talk to me and be like, oh, Sam, you're so inspiring, got such a growth mindset. I'm like, well, there's so many things that I haven't done that I probably could have done much better, and if I'd had more confidence. And I guess you see your own faults a lot more. Mm. But I definitely have felt like you've revealed a lot of my own faults a bit more again. I'm like, shit, I really can do a much better job of like some of the charity things that I'm doing.
I think it's also about remembering, like, I'm a true, like, I know it sounds really hippie, and like, I'm a true believer that everything happens for a reason. Mm. Like, everyone, you meet a particular person for a reason, and there's something that's going to come out of it. And like, bad things, good things, like, it's all part of a plan, and it's all perfectly timed for a particular reason. So maybe you weren't ready to have this conversation 6 months ago. You never know. Yeah. So actually, it's all part of the journey, really.
Yes. In terms of where can we find out more about popupartyandplay.com? Yes.
Indeed. So yeah, my website is www.popupartyandplay.co.uk, and our Instagram is popupartyplay, no and. And yeah, and I'm also on Instagram, so you can actually follow me personally at Leah Chowdhury. So it's L-E-A-H and then C-H-O-W-D-H-R-Y. So I put a lot of work that's kind of more charity stuff, and like my story about kind of what I'm doing next and who I'm helping and that kind of side of things on my personal one, a little bit more than my business. So yeah. If you're interested in either or, please do.
Sure, I definitely am. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learnt by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.